The third and final matter on our oral calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus William Young. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you'd like to use that time. The timing restrictions are indicated in the center podium, but you might choose to use either that podium or the podium that's closest to you. If you have any health concerns, we afford you the opportunity to choose. There's also a button in the middle of the podium. You can raise or lower it to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, William Young. Mr. Young was convicted following a jury trial of second-degree assault, and he raises several issues on appeal. Today, I'd like to focus on the errors that most impacted the trial, the court's refusal to instruct the jury on self-defense and defensive dwelling. The trial court abused its discretion by refusing to instruct the jury on self-defense and defensive dwelling because there was evidence to support both instructions. First, addressing self-defense. In Minnesota, a person may use reasonable force to resist an offense against the person. The finder of fact, in this case the jury, should decide whether the level of force that Mr. Young used to defend himself was reasonable. When an offense occurs in a home, the defendant has the burden of production of establishing three elements: the absence of provocation, an actual and honest belief that harm would result, and a reasonable basis for this belief. The law is clear that in close cases, the court must resolve any doubt in favor of the defendant and provide the instruction. The court in this case abused its discretion by applying the wrong standard. It applied the standard for deadly force, which requires the defendant to fear great bodily harm. And it can
see extent. It seems to me that a lot of this came down in the district court minds to the question of provocation and who was the instigator, who was the aggressor. And so to the extent there might have been a reference to the substantial bodily harm, is that an error that makes a difference if, in fact, the provocation piece was most significant?
I think it does, because the defense has a burden of production on all three elements. So the fact that the judge found that it made a mistake in that part of the analysis. But regarding the provocation issue, the mistake that the court made in that respect is that the court failed to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the party requesting the instruction. If the court had looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Young, it would have determined that Mr. Schramm forced his way into the house and assaulted Mr. Young. And Mr. Young responded by striking Mr. Schramm with his fist, not with a bat.
What was the one of the things that needs to be shown is that the victim was committing an independent assault on appellant at the time that appellant acted. What was the independent assault that Azias committed here?
Mr. Young's statement to Officer Renner that Mr. Schramm forced his way into the house and assaulted him. That was the evidence that was presented at trial.
And what was the assault?
The language was that he assaulted me.
So that was it. He assaulted me, but there wasn't.
That's correct.
There wasn't anything specific as to what he did. It wasn't like he ran at me. He cornered me in the wall. He came at me with fists raised. He had a weapon. It's just, he assaulted me. That was it?
That was the language that Officer Renner used when he testified, that Mr. Young gave a statement that Mr. Schramm forced his way into the house and assaulted him. So viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Young, then that is the evidence that Mr. Schramm had forced his way in and assaulted Mr. Young. And Mr. Young only had to fear bodily harm, not great bodily harm. An assault would inflict harm. So looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to
the
defense.
Would assault include bodily harm? Because assault can occur without any actual physical contact, right?
That's correct, but Your Honor, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, which the court was required to do and failed to do, it would assume the harm.
we have to assume that assault includes great bodily harm? Isn't that taking a step too far?
We wouldn't have to assume that it includes great bodily harm, but looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, yes, that it includes some form of harm. I also think that in layman's terms, when a defendant says he came in and assaulted me, assault implies some sort of physical altercation and not merely a verbal assault.
Again, I'm struggling a little bit because it seems like we're making more assumptions than in order to get to that point, though.
We don't necessarily need to make assumptions, Your Honor, but again, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable, if the defendant makes a statement that people forced their way into the house and assaulted him, looking at that evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, there is reason to believe that he feared harm.
But that's one piece of evidence, right? I mean, we had testimony from both the victim and your client's sister that painted a different picture, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So but what does looking at evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant mean?
That means taking what the defendant said, they forced their way into the house and assaulted me, at its face value, and not looking at all of the other evidence in the case. That was the mistake that the trial court made in Johnson, which is cited in the brief. In Johnson, the defendant claimed that the victim shot him in the head. There was a struggle for the gun, and then he shot her. There was overwhelming evidence that that was not the case, but the Minnesota Supreme Court in that case said, no, you have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, and even if there is overwhelming evidence on the other side, that is not sufficient.
There's another issue here, too, is ZS came into the house, appellant argues that he forced his way into the house and assaulted me, but then he left. He left the house, and it was only after the other alleged victim, after ZS saw the other alleged victim getting pushed down the stairs by appellant, that he re-entered the house. What is the assault, or what is the independent act that occurred there that second time, because that's really the one where the argument is made that appellant hit him with a bat. And so that actually is, you know, I understand your argument on the first time he entered, but that doesn't apply to the second one. There has to be, because this now we're talking about really a separate incident. What is the underlying crime that ZS committed when he re-entered the house?
To the first part of your question, I would disagree that this was a separate incident. This case is not like Conrad, which the state cited in its brief. In Conrad, there were three separate incidents there was an appreciable period of time intervening. In fact, between the second and third incidents in Conrad, the victim had fallen asleep. So there was an appreciable period of time. This is a very short period of time.
But there was still an intervening act. It wasn't like he was in the house the entire time. I think it would be a different situation. If he came in, appellant alleges he assaulted him, and he stays in the house, and it's part of an ongoing, you know, continuing act. Once ZS left the house, that seems to be a significant intervening act. So both parties have now disengaged from each other. And he only goes back into the house because he's seen appellant's sister being assaulted as well.
Well, he comes back into the house uninvited. Mr. Schramm had shown up at Mr. Young's house about 4 o'clock in the morning, extremely intoxicated, forces his way into the home and assaults. I mean, looking at this in the light most favorable to the defense, as the court was required to do. He leaves the house for a period of a minute, and then even though Mr. Young has made abundantly clear he does not want Ms. Joseph or Mr. Schramm there, he comes back into the house, and that in and of itself is an aggressive act. Coming back into the house suggests that this assault that occurred earlier hasn't yet ended. The state makes much of the fact that he came in with his hands in his pockets. Well, hands can be removed from pockets. The fact that he
right, comes but in how can I mean? Then that does get back to the fact that there's no testimony of when he reentered of him engaging in any underlying criminal activity of any kind. In fact, it's to the contrary. I believe it was unrebutted that he came in with his hands in his pockets. If that's the case, how can you, that seems to be as non-confrontational a stance as you can take in a situation like this.
Coming back into the house uninvited, I think, is a confrontational act in and of itself.
But it was in response to appellant assaulting his sister, though.
If you look at the facts in the light most favorable to the defense, no, it wasn't. And in fact, the jury acquits on the assaults involving the sister. But even assuming that self-defense wasn't appropriate here, which I believe that it was, the court also abused its discretion by refusing to instruct on defensive dwelling. To obtain an instruction for defensive dwelling, the defendant has the burden of establishing two things. First, that he was in lawful possession of real property, and that he was resisting a trespass or other unlawful interference with the property. That was clearly met here. There is no dispute that he was the owner of the house, and there's really no dispute that the two people entered the house uninvited, that they were trespassing on his property.
Can you address the state's argument that the jury essentially, well, that there's no harm here because the jury's different treatment of the guilty or not guilty as to the two potential victims indicated that the jury was sua sponte applying a self-defense standard, and therefore there was no harm?
There is no case law support whatsoever for that position. We presume that jurors follow the instructions that they are given. In this case, there was no self-defense instruction given. They specifically asked about self-defense, and the court told them to rely on the instructions they had been given. There are also other reasons that the court or the jury could have acquitted. It's not based solely on self-defense. It's harder to imagine clearer evidence of an impact on a verdict than a jury coming back and saying, we're having discussion that some of this could be self-defense. The state also argues that the error was harmless because it's unreasonable to strike someone with a baseball bat under these circumstances. But again, that's not viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense. In the light most favorable to the defense, the strike occurred with a ring, with a fist, not with a baseball bat. There have been cases where appellate courts have found acts unreasonable as a matter of law, but in those cases, even viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, the actions were unreasonable. Glowacki is a good example of that. The jury in this case should have been given the option to determine what happened, whether a fist or a bat was used, and then decide whether the level of force was reasonable, either in self-defense or in defense of dwelling. There is a reasonable probability that the errors impacted the verdict, and Mr. Young asks this court to reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. I just want to address a couple of things that arguments raised by appellant. That this was a fact issue for the jury, yes, but as the Supreme Court notes in Glowacki, and I'm just quoting from page 403, generally a reasonableness determination is properly made by the finder of fact, in this case the jury. However, when no reasonable mind could draw an adverse inference, the question may be decided as a matter of law. And I think we can look at every level of this and find that there's simply no evidence to look at. Counsel rightfully cites to the case law that the evidence has to be viewed in a light most favorable to the defendant seeking the instruction. But there's simply no evidence that there was any threat posed, assault otherwise. There's no threat posed by the victim.
What about defense of property? Case law, the statute allows an individual to defend one's own property against a trespass.
Certainly, but he's standing in the, I think we need to look then at the level of the trespass. He's just standing in the entryway. He's walked into the door with his hands in his pockets. He's not taking anything. He's not breaking anything.
Doesn't have to be a theft. Doesn't have to be any damage to property, just a trespass.
Correct. But my next point is, even in response to that, your response to that trespass has to be reasonable. And yes, we can say, well, was the injuries caused by the ring? Was it caused by the bat? I don't know that there's, when you listen to the recording, I don't see how you can come to the conclusion that these injuries were made by a bat.
But the argument was made that they weren't. And at some point, how close do we have to get to a factual dispute before we say, give it to the jury?
Well, Glowacki says, when no reasonable minds could, and regardless of how ZS received his injuries, he came out of that with a concussion. He was incoherent, lost consciousness for a period of time, and ended up in the ER.
So
for somebody who walked into your home and just came in the entryway, and that's all they did, I don't think any reasonable mind can come to the conclusion that's a reasonable response.
A juror could not conclude if someone who is significantly impaired by alcohol steps into one's home, that a punch in the head is unreasonable. You'd say that is beyond a jury's determination. It should go to the court.
Well, there's a punch in the head and there's a blow to the ribs that leaves a mark. So there's two blows. Yes, this man is intoxicated, but it's not like this is just some man off the street. This is the appellant's best friend, brought there by his half-sister to do what? Bring the laptop that the appellant had been texting and requesting, demanding that be brought back. So
those sound like the facts that you would argue to the jury, but are those the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant? I mean, the characterization of the approach, and I'm just here to return your laptop, here with my sister, as opposed to the defendant's characterization of the events.
Glowacki says you have to be act reasonably. As a matter of law, this was not a reasonable act. And if that's the case, then it doesn't go to the jury.
So we're clear, we would be holding that, viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant, that an individual who encroaches into one's home, highly intoxicated, late hour of the night, that a punch in the head and the side to get the person out of the home is, as a matter of law, unreasonable. So unreasonable that we're not going to give the jury the opportunity to decide self-defense. Am I correct in the characterization?
Yes, and in the result? But you left a couple of points out.
All right.
That he was struck hard enough in the head, that he received a concussion, lost consciousness, and ended up in the ER. He was struck hard enough in the ribs that he had a contusion. Now, the fact that he's intoxicated cuts both ways.
Contusion is just a bruise, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. One that, as testified by, does not match a fist. The police officer testified.
No, I understand that. But, I mean, dispute still about whether it was a bat or a fist exists.
Not on the rib. There's no evidence that the testimony or the argument is he had blood on his ring, which would be consistent with the blow to the head. But the police officer testified, who, and I can't remember which one, if it was Officer Renner or the other one, but he's an EMT with 18 years of experience. He looked at that picture and he said, it's a long oval contusion that is consistent with being made with a bat. So there's no evidence that he was struck on the ribs with a fist. So there's no evidence that, well, we can look at that in his favor. The evidence establishes he was hit in the ribs with a baseball bat. So, okay, he gets hit on the head, but he gets hit in the ribs with a baseball bat. The fact that he's intoxicated, again, I was getting to that, it cuts both ways. How many times do you have to hit this guy to get him out of your house? Oh, by the way, he could have simply kept him out of the house. He was standing outside for at least a minute, long enough to make these videos. That's uncontested evidence. That doesn't have to go to a jury. Anybody can look at and see how long those videos cumulatively are. So he's outside, he comes back in, and he gets attacked. There's no evidence of the first four parts. There's no evidence that would support any of those factors. But getting to that reasonableness part, I just don't think it's reasonable to hit your best friend when he's intoxicated standing in your entryway.
Well, saying I don't think it's reasonable differs from it's unreasonable as a matter of law.
Right, I misspoke. I don't think a reasonable mind could draw an adverse inference. I don't think that's reasonable.
You didn't incorporate into your answer the audio recording of comments made by the defendant. How, if at all, do they bear on the analysis?
I think in order for the defendant to get the instruction, he needed to take the stand and address what's on those recordings. The way around that is to say, that's not my voice. That's not me threatening to kill him. Yeah, that's my house, but that recording wasn't made that night. That isn't evidence that is subject to a credibility determination, and it's not evidence.
How do the comments of the defendant work into the analysis of reasonableness, if at all?
They fit better, or I think they carry more import on the first part, the lack of aggression or provocation. Clearly the provocateur at that point in time is the appellant. And it also goes to whether there was an actual belief. He doesn't seem to be scared of ZS at all. He's mad at him. He's not afraid of anything. He's just mad. And I think this is an anger that has carried over from earlier in the evening. So
is that viewing the evidence the light most favorable to appellant, though, to assume that he's mad at him, he's not in fear, because he did say he basically burst into his house and assaulted him in the first instance?
Well, it's circumstantial evidence, but given the tone of voice that he's using and the language he uses, he's screaming at him, I'm going to fucking kill you. I don't know how you can read that other than he is really, really mad. I don't know how you can read that any other way.
That bears on the self-defense, but not necessarily defense of property, correct? I mean, you're saying, well, this shows he's not really afraid. Well, afraid that he would be injured, but that doesn't have any bearing on whether he is defending his property from an intrusion. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I can see your point on that. Yeah. I can, with respect to the first prong of it, yeah, I can see your point on that. But again, coming back to the reasonableness, I do want to touch briefly.
Counsel, before you leave that topic, I just want to have this more kind of a fundamental clarifying question. Because we do need to look at it in light most favorable to appellant. My question is, you referenced a number of items, the testimony of the officer in terms of the injury to his skull being more oblong which seems to indicate that it would, the injury came from a bat versus a fist, which would probably be more of a rounder shape, and the injury to the side. When we look at the evidence in light most favorable to appellant, what does that mean in terms of other evidence, and in particular, any evidence that may have been unrefuted?
Well, that's interesting, because the case law, going back, I think, to the first Johnson, which is 310 Northwest 2nd, talks about that there has to be reasonable evidence. So it isn't, well, it's just whatever the defendant says, we take at face value. Even the second state v. Johnson, talks about, and this is, I'm reading from 719 at 631, we acknowledge that determining whether Johnson met his burden on this element is a close call, but we have made clear that, quote, in keeping with the presumption of innocence, trial courts should resolve all doubts as to the legitimacy of a self-defense claim in favor of the defendant. So they talk about resolving doubts as opposed to resolving evidence. And they go on to talk about how the Court of Appeals and the state rely upon evidence that supports a version of events in which Johnson shot bottom of first and then sought himself. That evidence may, in the Court of Appeals' words, overwhelmingly establish that Johnson did not act in self-defense. But that evidence contradicts other evidence that supports Johnson's claim. So they do a minimal, and I think that just goes to whether it's reasonable or not. And I think that the biggest problem is that there was a break in time. And yes, the defendant's bare statement, he burst into the home and assaulted me. Well, that's the first part. But the second part, he then has to come forward with evidence. Even the State v. Johnson, the 310 Northwest 2nd 96, that cited an appellant's brief, and I'm reading from page 97, we need not decide whether the requested instruction accurately reflects the law, because it is clear that defendant could not have been prejudiced by the lack of such an instruction, there being no reasonable evidence that the victim was committing an independent assault on defendant at the time defendant fired the gun. So there's no evidence indicating that he was committing any kind of assault on appellant at the time he struck him. So then the only issue is, was this reasonable defense of property and as a matter of law?
There was a different element of your harmless error argument that I wanted you to address, this idea that, well, the jury acquitted as to the other victim, therefore the jury must have at least contemplated self-defense, therefore there is no harmless error. The argument is a little bit difficult, because we don't know why a jury is acquitting anyone. But you, I gather, would like us to assume that it must be because the jury had self-defense in his mind, number one, and properly analyzed the elements of self-defense. And why would we make that assumption, either of those assumptions?
The jury told the judge that self-defense is an issue. And they're going about it without the jury instruction. I'm going to run out of time here.
Well, you'll be able to answer the question, though.
Thank you.
No Safe by the Bell today, so.
So we know that they're thinking about it.
Do we know that they understand the elements of it and can properly apply it?
That's one of the things where I was going. I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that had they been given the instruction, they would have found him guilty of the misdemeanor assault against the sister. That assault is caught on the video. They're arguing on the steps. You can hear them arguing. And then he just starts walking up the steps and he kicks her in the chest.
So I understand from your answer that you believe that the jury misunderstands the elements of self-defense. Didn't properly apply it.
I absolutely think so. I don't think that there was any evidence really presented that would go forward.
Right, but if the jury misunderstands the elements of self-defense, isn't that the reason to provide the instruction so that they properly analyze self-defense? I thought your argument in your brief was, well, we know they understand self-defense because they applied it here, therefore it's harmless.
My argument was made in response to appellant's argument, which was that the jury was left with only one option, find my client guilty. My response is no, there was another option. The jury seemed to apply the rule of lenity and just come up with their own self-defense and applied it to this case. I don't think there was evidence sufficient. I was not shocked at all that the jury acquitted on the second-degree assault conviction. But watching that video and watching the appellant plant his foot into the sister's chest, how can you acquit him of that assault? There had to have been something more, and that something more is their self-defense, which was, I think, poorly applied.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
A number of the arguments that the state makes is really about facts, and those fact determinations were better left to the jury. The jury should have been given the option to determine what happened here and to determine whether the acts were reasonable. The court's refusal to provide instructions on self-defense and defensive dwelling took that away from the jury. There was some discussion about the comments made on the tape. And those comments simply could be threats. It's really irrelevant to the point of self-defense or defensive dwelling. It could be simply something, a lot of bluster to try and scare someone out of the house without having to use force. So I don't know that is necessarily makes the use of force unreasonable. There is also discussion here about the level of injury that Mr. Schramm sustained, and I would agree that he had injury to his head and to his side. The medical report said possible concussion. He was advised to treat with ice and ibuprofen. It wasn't a very serious assault like some of the cases that are mentioned in the briefs.
But isn't a blow to the head, isn't that pretty serious? I mean, possible concussion. Concussions, as we're learning more and more, can be very, very serious and in fact, deadly. And the one officer testified that this looks like it was a blow by a weapon such as a bat, because it was more oblong versus something that would indicate being hit by a fist. That seems pretty serious to me.
And that injury, I believe, is referring to the one on the side and not the injury to the head. I am not suggesting that a concussion is not a serious injury, but I think that it was perhaps overstated that this was a serious concussion. The medical records said a possible concussion, and then if you look at the treatment recommendations, it was to treat with ice and ibuprofen.
What is the appellant's position as to whether there is a dispute of fact as to what caused the injury to the ribs?
The appellant's position is that there was no bat used, and that was, and looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, there was no bat used. The fact that there is some conflicting evidence with that, that's a fact question, and that, again, is for the finder of fact to decide. The actions taken by Mr. Young in this case were not so far outside the pale as, for example, in Glowacki, that it would be unreasonable as a matter of law.
Do you agree that we might reach a decision that it was unreasonable as a matter of law if the facts were undisputed that a baseball bat was used to defend a trespass?
I don't know that this court should find that. This is a trespass by a highly intoxicated person at 4 o'clock in the morning. I think that, and this is a person who has come into the house twice after it was made extremely clear that they were not wanted there. So I think that a reasonable jury could find that that was a reasonable use of force.
But we do need to look at the facts and context. And it's not like this was a stranger. It's not like this was a neighbor who was completely unwanted, who continues to, you know, violate another neighbor's property. You know, he even made the comment at some point, you know, come on, you're my friend. And these are people, these were best friends. This wasn't, it just seems a little unusual in terms of the level of you know, force and response that is being used when you're talking about somebody who officiated at your wedding, who you've known for many, many years, and comes with your half-sister. This isn't, if I recall correctly, I think there was even testimony that it was not uncommon for them to enter each other's houses unannounced, which seems to indicate a level of friendship that's pretty significant. So, you know, given all of that, all those facts as well, and I think those were undisputed, so I think those, even if we view the evidence light most favorable, I don't think any of that is disputed. I think that really puts it in a very, very different light in terms of what had occurred here.
Those are certainly factors that a jury, as a finder of fact, could consider. But I think, unfortunately, our case law is rife with situations where relationships between family members and friends go bad, and especially when you've got a highly intoxicated person showing up at 4 o'clock in the morning, repeatedly being told that they are not
based on a request to return the laptop that appellant had left at his residence, at Zs's residence.
Again, looking at all of the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Young in this case, I don't think you can say that it was unreasonable as a matter of law. The jury should have been the one to make that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your briefing and also for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. This is our last case on our calendar for today, so we are in recess. Enjoy the rest of the day.